Thank you, Frank, and thanks everybody for coming out tonight. That's a big crowd. I usually hide safely behind my computer and spot out that way, so this is a little different for me. So, I'd like to start standing here in the pulpit. I guess this would be the text of my sermon that I'm preaching from. And it comes from the recent State of the Union address by President Bush. I think it's important because it gets at, I think it's deeply revealing, and it gets at the fundamental contradiction in how the United States functions in the world today. America is a nation with a mission, the president said. And that mission comes from our most basic beliefs. We have no desire to dominate, no ambitions of empire. Our aim is a democratic peace, a peace founded upon the dignity and rights of every man and woman. America acts in this cause with friends and allies at our side. Yet we understand our special calling. This great republic will lead the cause of freedom. Now, those are fine sounding words. And some of them I actually agree with. Like the president, I too think that America is a nation with a mission and with a special calling. I too believe that leading the cause of freedom around the world is part of that mission. But other parts of the president's words are clearly false. Contrary to the president's statement, we are indeed an empire. We do seek to dominate. It's not by accident that we do so. We seek to dominate. I think on this issue, the facts are utterly indisputable. We Americans account for 4% of the world's population. Yet that tiny little 4% spends more on bombs and tanks and jets and soldiers and missiles than the remaining 96% of the world put together. Now think about that. The American 4% spends more than the non-American 96%. And yet we do not seek to dominate. Furthermore, the bulk of that military power is not deployed here. In fact, here in the United States, where it would be used to defend our own territory. The Pentagon is so little concerned with protecting the borders of the United States that we have been forced to create a separate agency, the Department of Homeland Security, to perform that role for us. Instead, our military is designed to project power outward, well beyond our borders. We supposedly, again, do not wish to dominate, to act as an empire, but we have military bases now in more than 140 countries around the world, and that number continues to grow. I think that's an astounding number when you think about it, because the United Nations only has 191 members. And I'm sure that most Americans would be shocked to discover the true extent of our far-flung military capability. I think if you did a poll, for instance, I bet that most Americans would put the number of countries in which we have bases of no more than 20 or 30 of that. I think it's interesting to compare historically as well. The British Empire, by every account, was an empire. At its peak, it had military bases in roughly 35 countries. So, by any reasonable definition of the word, I think we are an empire. Trying to insist we are not is like trying to insist we will still find WMD in Iraq. It ain't gonna happen. What I really find fascinating, though, and revealing about the president's words is the need he feels to make that statement. Why did he feel it necessary to tell us that we have no desire to dominate, no ambitions of empire, when we so clearly do? The reason that our president is in denial is that we as a people are in denial. We understand at a very deep level that ambitions of empire and dominance violate fundamental American principles. In fact, I think they so directly contradict our image of who we think we are as a country that we are incapable of accepting the truth about ourselves. If we are America, we cannot possibly be an empire. If we are an empire, we cannot possibly be American. Those two cannot coexist in our minds. Yet they do. Now, there are many in this world, many in this country, probably some in this room, who believe that our power is a bad thing. Personally, I don't. I believe it could be a bad thing. I think that it has been a bad thing in some ways, in too many ways. It's been a bad thing because of the way we've used it. It's been a bad thing because we've allowed that power to go to our heads and cloud our thinking and seduce us into betraying our national values. But I also believe that the power of the United States has the potential to be a very good thing for ourselves and the world. Because again, like the president, I believe this nation does have a special calling. But we have to understand that if there is such a thing as American exceptionalism, its source lies not in our military, but in the principles that we claim to honor and try to live by. I think if we employ our power in ways that honor what has always been best about this country, what has made us unique in world history, then we can reap enormous benefits, not just for ourselves, but for every human being on the planet. But if we're going to realize that potential, we have to admit the truth. I fear that our refusal to acknowledge the true nature of our power and responsibilities, our current will force our current position to be transitory, temporary, and that we will miss a historic opportunity as a result. I think there are several essential reasons we have to be honest about with ourselves about who we are and what we're trying to do. The first is that while we may fool ourselves with our denials of empire or dominance, we do not fool other nations. They're at the business end of empire, so to speak. As a result, they see it much more clearly than we do. I know this because I grew up as a child of the empire. My father was a 28-year enlisted man in the U.S. Air Force. We were stationed at bases in Japan, in Germany, in Italy. And I saw how people there reacted to what was going on around them. Today, in more than 140 nations around the world, people see U.S. tanks rumbling through their towns. They see U.S. jets flying overhead. They see U.S. ships in their harbors, uniformed U.S. soldiers in their nightclubs and their stores. They also see their elected politicians and leaders doing the bidding of the Americans, often in direct contradiction to the wishes of their own people. So try telling them we're not an empire. It's dangerous for Americans to be blind to that, to the resentment that breeds. If we do not understand how others see us, we cannot understand how they will react to what we do. If we claim to be fighting for freedom and democracy, while others see us as imperialists out to stretch our power, we will not understand why they refuse to help us. I think that is a description of what has happened with the Iraq War. If we make them decide you're either with us or against us, well, given our power, they will be with us in name, but not in reality. And there's nothing more dangerous than an ally whose support is given reluctantly, grudgingly. In times of need, that kind of friend can be more dangerous to you than an enemy. So what are these principles that in the past have helped to make America exceptional among the nations of the world? I would argue that the core of those principles is a deep distrust of unrestricted power in any form. When we rebelled against the British in 1776, it was a rebellion against raw, unrestricted power. When we established our own government, we set up competing branches, the executive, the judiciary, the legislature, so that there was no single center of power. We also passed the Bill of Rights to further curtail the power of government. We did not trust centralized power. As Americans, I think we have understood that power that was forced to justify itself, to prove itself, to prove itself legitimate over and over again, would be the type of power that lasted and that would be just and fair. We were the first people in the modern era to understand that. Now, however, when we are offered the chance to be an unrestricted power ourselves, we're forgetting that lesson. We're being seduced into betraying our heritage. It is a violation of what of our own understanding of how the world ought to work. It is a repudiation of basic American values. Now, the second reason I think we need to be honest about this is even more serious. Earlier, I rattled off some statistics, that's a hard word to say, to bolster my case that we are an empire. And the frightening thing is that even though we spend more on our military than the rest of the world combined, it is still not enough. As the WAND presentation pointed out earlier, President Bush has requested more than $400 billion in the Pentagon budget next year, an increase of $27 billion over a previous increase of $40 billion. And even that won't be enough. The most powerful military in the history of the planet is today greatly overextended. We're overextended militarily, we're overextended economically. And we cannot sustain this situation for long. Today, for example, we have more than 40% of our ground forces tied up in Iraq. In the Army, the saying is, if you're in the Army, you're either in Iraq, going to Iraq, or coming home from Iraq. Which leaves us quite vulnerable and susceptible in places like Korea and elsewhere. So despite the fact that 4% is outspending and 96%, we still don't have enough. It is an insatiable beast. The military readiness of our forces has probably since the Korean War. We've had to force our military personnel to stay in uniform against their will beyond their enlisted term, because we just don't have the means to replace them. But yet there's no talk of restarting the draft. The Bush administration is also refusing to seek permanent increases in the size of our standing military. They deny the military is overextended. They deny the need for additional personnel. Now why? I think the answer takes us back to the president's statement in his State of the Union. The answer lies in our reluctance to admit that we are an empire and that we do seek dominance. Think back to the weeks and months before the Iraq War, when the Bush administration was telling us that the cost of rebuilding Iraq could be covered with Iraqi oil revenues. Remember that? And when White House economics advisor Lawrence Lindsay dared to suggest that wasn't true, that reconstruction would cost taxpayers at least $100 billion, which proved to be a vast underestimate, he was shouted down by his colleagues in the Bush administration and quietly ushered out the door. He had made the mistake of telling us the truth. Likewise, when General Eric Shinseki, the Army Chief of Staff, suggested that occupying Iraq would take hundreds of thousands of troops, he too was shouted down and humiliated by his superiors in the Bush administration. And why? The administration knew that if the true costs and dangers of an Iraq invasion were understood, the American public would not go along. They knew we would have to be fooled into Iraq. They did it by vastly exaggerating the dangers that Iraq posed to us and vastly underestimating and disguising the immense risks and costs. Even now, the administration knows it will need another $40 billion for Iraq reconstruction and occupation this year. Yet it refuses to acknowledge that fact. It will make the budget request only after the November elections. Now, I think that in this sense, as in many others, Iraq is a microcosm of our larger problems. In Iraq, our ambitions are grander than our willingness to pay for them. The same is true of our overall strategy. Our grand ambitions outweigh our willingness to invest in them. The administration is trying to implement a policy of global military dominance on the sly, without admitting that it is doing so. And the key to success in that endeavor is to deny the true cost to the American people. Now, another way it is denying the true cost is by dumping the expense of military growth and our Iraq adventure into the federal deficit. We aren't paying for this expansion ourselves. Quite the contrary. While we're expanding the Pentagon budget by $25, $40 billion a year, we're merely giving ourselves tax cuts. So as a result, today we are paying as taxpayers just 78% for every dollar that we demand from the government in goods and services and benefits. The rest we're charging to the future, to be collected in taxes from people who are today still in grade school, people who have no voice, no vote, and no power. Now think about that. Think about what we're doing here. This is taxation without representation. We today are acting like King George. We are stealing from the future earnings of our children and grandchildren so that we can pay for the services and benefits we want. It meets the classic definition of colonialism. But instead of going to another country and forcing them to give us their resources, we are reaching ahead in time and stealing those resources from the bank accounts and wallets and pocketbooks of our own children. Today we have a federal deficit, an annual federal deficit of $500 billion. That's by far the biggest in U.S. history, and that figure doesn't adequately describe it because it doesn't include probably about $200 billion that's coming out of the Social Security Trust Fund. It's disguising the true nature, the true size of our deficit. By one measure, the gap between what we have admitted ourselves to spend on our military, Social Security, Medicare, interest on the debt, etc., what our expenditures are, and the difference between that and the tax system, what the tax system is expected to collect, is $45 trillion. Now that creates problems in a whole wide range of areas, but for the moment, let's keep our attention on military terms. If the Bush administration succeeds in quietly, slowly committing us to a policy of global military domination without first getting the public support and buy-in and commitment to pay for that policy, we're headed for very real trouble. Because historically, it has always been easier and safer to expand an empire than to withdraw from it. Once we introduce our military into a region, once we become the major source of stability in that region, it becomes very difficult to pull out without creating enormous instability and chaos. Look what happened on the Indian subcontinent when the British pulled out after World War II. The whole place went to hell. The Muslims and the Hindus started purging and killing each other by the hundreds of thousands. That's what happens when an empire starts to retract. That's, if we push ourselves into these areas, we are making a long-term commitment that is very difficult and dangerous to withdraw from. Now, other countries are also facing budget deficits, but they have options open to them that we do not, or that we choose not to take anyway. Germany, for instance, recently announced that in order to cut its deficit, it was reducing the size of its military by 35,000 personnel. It was closing 100 bases and reducing its defense budget by $33 billion by 2010. Now the Germans know they can take that step without endangering their national security, because the United States has already promised to take care of it for them. We have committed to being not just the overwhelming military power globally, but within each region of the globe. President Bush has said that it is his intention to make the U.S. military so overpowering that it would be pointless for others to try to keep up with us. The Germans say, fine. They'll let us pay for security. They'll let us die for security. And they'll take that money that they would have spent on that and they'll use it for education and health care and pensions and environmental cleanups. And what's happening while we devote more and more of our treasure to our military? Well, for one thing, as we saw in the WAN presentation again, our education budgets are being slammed. And that's utter foolishness. We already know that nations such as China and Mexico and India are taking what we see as American jobs. We know, we understand that over the long term, continued American prosperity and also our continued ability to project military power depends on our ability to educate our people. But we're cutting education budgets anyway. There's an old expression to describe what we're doing. We're eating our seed corn. We're taking the seed that ought to be set aside to be planted next year for next year's crop, and we're eating it now. And devil take the future. Now, I said at the beginning, this is the early days of a potential tragedy, I believe. But because, again, I do think that the enormous power and authority of the United States of America at this point in history can be an incredible force for progress, justice, and freedom. It can be, but it is not. We should be using our strength to lead, not to coerce other nations. Through leadership, not coercion, other nations will agree to help us, rather than sit on the sideline in sullen silence. Through leadership, not coercion, we can be true to the ideals that made this country unique, not least among them a deep distrust of overwhelming power, even our own. We should be using our dominance as a tool for pursuing the advance of freedom and democracy. Instead, we are using freedom and democracy as tools to further our dominance. And if we do not reverse that course soon, I don't think history will be quick to forgive us. Now, I'd like to close with what I think is our fundamental mistake today. And let me begin this final section with an observation. For some reason, even though we spend more than the rest of the world combined on our military, and even though we have the exceedingly dangerous Mexico to the south and the even more dangerous Canada to the north and a huge ocean to the east and another one to the west, for some reason we Americans still feel unsafe. That makes no sense to me. How could that be? I can only think of two explanations. One is that in reality we are as safe and secure as it is possible for human beings to be. But we have been made to feel insecure by those who seek to take advantage of our fear. And I think there's some truth to that explanation. On the other hand, what if the danger we feel is real? What if we truly are threatened? The events of September 11th still hang heavily over our heads. But if that's the case, if all the blood and lives and treasure that we are investing in defense have still failed to make us feel secure, then I would suggest we are doing something very, very wrong, and that we should drastically rethink our approach. So here's what I think our fundamental mistake has been. I think that we are seeking security by trying to control the world. And you just can't do that. American history, world history, says such a thing is impossible. 4% of the world's population cannot control the other 96% no matter how much we spend. Yet that is in essence the strategy that the Bush administration has chosen to adopt and is trying quietly to commit this nation to undertake. We still have time to change. we still have time to say no and to take another course. I hope very much for the future of this nation and the world that we do so. But at this time in history, nobody else has the power to force America to change course. Only Americans, you and I, have that power. Thank you.